It is Monday, January 22nd. This is the Christian Commute. You're riding home with your host, Seth Dunn. There go the show notes. It's going to be one of those days. It's rainy here in Georgia. Oh, somebody's trying to back up. Listen, what do y'all do when you get in the parking lot and somebody's trying to back out while you're trying to go? Do you stop and let them go? Do they stop and let you go? What do you do? I'm an aggressive driver, I'll just say that. Reaffix my show notes. Thank you to everyone who wrote in over the weekend. I have 3 submissions in the inbox now, so we'll have at least 3 out of 5 weekly shows with questions to answer, full shows. So today is a full show. Got a question about Jewish people and heaven. Today's show topic is called Threats from Within, Business Models. Threats from Within, Business Models. It's the one I kept delaying with more interesting or timely subjects, but I'm finally going to get to it today. But before we get to those things, we're going to do Ephesians chapter 4, verses 7 through 8 in the Bible chapter review. Ephesians chapter 4, verses 7 through 8 in the Bible chapter review. So, to each of us grace was given, says Paul. To each of us grace was given. So, grace is a gift, right? And he says it was given according to the measure of Christ's gift. So really, you get it according to the Lord's measure. You get your grace. Everyone has grace. Of course, we all have the grace given to us to believe and be saved. But Paul isn't just talking about the grace given to believe and be saved here in this passage. Now, that's in view. I think that's always in view. We're talking about grace. But as I've said other times, I'll say again, Christianity is not about getting saved. It's about being saved. So when Paul writes these epistles, he's writing them to churches full of people who should already be saved, or should have already gotten saved, and he's telling them how to be saved. Right? He's talked about unity here. He's talked about having humility and tolerance for one another in Ephesians. He's about to start talking about the different grace gifts given to people in the church here in the rest of this chapter. So this is about what you do with the grace God gives you. Yes, there's grace to get saved, but there's also grace to do many other things within the church, to teach, to preach, etc. All right? And this grace is given according to the measure of Christ's gift. So there's no room for pride in these gifts, as we saw when we reviewed the Corinthian epistles. One person is not more important than the other just because their gift may be more prominent or seemingly useful or impressive. Because when it comes down to it, all the gifts come from God and nobody did anything to earn them. So when you're talking about grace gifts or grace that was given to you, you have to understand that in the sense, and I don't want to say holistic just because I think that's kind of a hippie word, in a holistic sense, because you can't earn grace. Think about that. Grace is something that is given, and it can only be given. You can't earn what you're given. It's not like a wage. Like, I earned a bunch of money today at work. I went there, I logged on my computer, I clicked on all my spreadsheets and said, we're going to do this, and hey, you people over there, look at that. And I went to the warehouse and I looked at something and I said, that looks good, and hey, you need to do this. And then I came back to my office and typed up some more spreadsheets. I earned my money today because I showed up and I did my work. So Thursday, when payday rolls around, and I get all my money in my bank account, I'm not going to think, oh, what a nice gift that my employer has given me. No, I earned it. Now, like, when I show up at home and my mom and dad come over and like give me something, here's something, my couch. I've got my mom's old couch in my basement. That was a gift. I didn't give my mom any money for it. I didn't earn it. She just gave it to me. It's a gift. I didn't earn that couch like I earned my money. So grace is always something that is given, all right, by its nature. I think the verb here for given is didomai, and then we're talking about charis. You give grace, or at least God gives grace, all right? But even when you show grace to other people, they didn't earn that grace from you. Otherwise, what you're giving them wouldn't be grace. By its nature, grace can only be given and not earned. And since your grace cannot be earned, sorry, Roman Catholics and other works-based religions, since you cannot synergistically earn your grace, you really can't be boastful in it, can you? So that's what Paul is keeping in view here. The grace is given to each of us according to the measure of Christ. And then he goes on to quote the Old Testament. He quotes Psalm 68. That's why it's in all caps in your New American Standard Bible. Therefore, it says, when he ascended on high, he led captive a host of captives and gave gifts to men. And so Paul is applying this psalm to Christ, who descended to earth and descended into Sheol when he died and preached to the souls in prison. I think that's in 2 Peter. All right. So Christ frees captives. We were dead in our sin. We were captives to the God of this world and dead in our sin. And he came. And he died for our sins. He broke sin's curse over us so that we could be saved. So he ascended on high, thus freeing us, because he ascended from the grave. The resurrection's part of us, part of it. And thus he freed us from sin so that we were no longer captives. The psalmist makes mention of a host of captives. So a host would be an army. So imagine a captured army. And they're in prison, and they've been defeated, and their leader comes and, you know, defeats their captors, busts them out, and frees the captives. And he gives them gifts. All right. So we were dead in our sins, unable and unwilling to live for God. We were granted the ability to believe. Christ did his atoning work, resurrected from the dead, and freed us, and then gave us gifts because we belong to him, and he's given gifts to operate in his church. So as we explore these gifts and the things that God has given to us in the church, as we continue in chapter 4, keep that in mind, that grace isn't earned. And as always, when you're talking to people about salvation, this is a salient point. For it is by grace you have been saved, not works, lest any man should boast. It is by grace you have been saved, and this not of yourselves, not by works, lest any man should boast. You cannot boast in your salvation. You did not earn it. You cannot boast in your grace gifts. You did not earn them. In fact, the term grace gifts is superfluous. It's like saying gift gifts. I should stop using it. So forgive me for using it. Hopefully going forward in the rest of the shows in the Christian commute, I'll never say grace gifts again. Just your grace that's given to you. All right. So let's go to the Christian Commute inbox. Jeff from Northwest Georgia writes in. Jeff is a local. He could be on I-75 with me right now. I think I'm still in Gordon County. How do modern Jews think they are going to heaven without Jesus? That's his question. Now let's get to the presupposition. You're a Christian, Jeff. You've got the New Testament. It's the New Testament that talks about heaven and hell. All right, so think about this. In our evangelistic mindset as evangelicals, all right, Baptists, Presbyterians, is there anybody else who believes the Bible? I don't want to count the Holy Rollers, but they have the same mindset. We always talk about heaven and hell. We go evangelize somebody. If you died today, do you know if you'd go to heaven or hell? What would happen if you died today? And we know they're thinking when we ask them, what would happen to you if you died today? They're thinking, well, do I go to heaven or hell? All right. So first, Jeff, before we talk about heaven, we need to talk about what Jews think about hell. All right. So since Jews don't recognize the New Testament, they only recognize the Old Testament, what they would call the OT, the only Testament. They don't see any New Testament authority. When we start talking about hell and the place with the weeping and the gnashing of teeth, the place where the worm does not die, the smoke of their torment goes up forever and ever, they don't put any stock in the New Testament idea of hell at all. So when Jesus is warning people about hell, they just don't believe it. That's not authoritative to them. And I'm not sure there's anything about hell in the Old Testament, just Sheol. Now, somebody can correct me if I'm wrong. Precious little teachings about the afterlife in the Old Testament. There's an assumption that when people die, they go to Sheol. But there's not an assumption that Sheol is fiery torment. So your average Jew, your average modern-day Jew, is not thinking in terms of heaven and hell. They're not afraid of hell. So if you ever ask a Jewish person about what they believe about hell, you'll probably find that. And of course, it's a diverse set of beliefs. You know, modern Jews, Orthodox Jews, non-Orthodox Jews. I mean, there's all different kind of Jews, just like there's all different denominations of Christians. So it's hard to speak for one group. But they don't really believe in hell like Christians believe in hell. And they don't really believe in heaven like Christians believe in heaven. So understanding that they don't recognize the New Testament, Jeff, you'd have to think of what do they think about Sheol and what do they think about the resurrection? Because even before the New Testament was written, there was an idea about the resurrection. So Jews, some may and some may not, expect a resurrection. But it's not about getting to heaven with them because Christ's blood paid for their sins. So they're still celebrating to this day Yom Kippur. One of the questions I've always had is, how in the world do Jews feel like they're atoned for on Yom Kippur when they're not making animal sacrifices anymore? And I'm sure some modern Jewish theologian has an idea of that. Hold on, I'm in a tight squeeze. Michael from Arizona, I'm passing a white car from Florida. Michael from Arizona wrote in today to let me know that he was on a business trip in Florida and he requested a white car with a Florida license plate. So some poor driver in Florida is behind Michael going slow right now, living it up as some Florida local. And here I am stuck between tractor trailers and I'm not going to get to pass this accursed white car from Florida. You longtime listeners of the show know that I detest being stuck behind white cars from Florida. Yankees drive slow, especially if they're from Florida. You say, Seth, people from Florida aren't Yankees. Yes, they are. They came here from some northern state. They got old. They have socks with sandals, and they went to the early bird special at Barnhill's on Thursday at 4:30 to get a $6.15 dinner. They left a 10% tip. Then they walked out of Barnhill's wearing khaki shorts and flip-flops, or not flip-flops, but sandals with socks or white tennis shoes. They got into their white car and they drove 40 miles an hour back to their old folks' condo home. And then every once in a while, they want to leave the state of Florida to go back from whence they came. And they get on I-75, and every day they get in front of me. Now I'm still stuck behind this Floridian, because when I tried to pass him again, I got stuck behind a budget rent-a-car moving truck. All right, so somebody's rented U-Haul. So now, oh gosh, let's not die. Sorry, there's a tractor-trailer getting over. Now I've got the third lane free. No, it's not! Why can't I get in front of this person? Jeff, I'm sorry. I mean, I'm trying to answer your question. It's raining. People are driving too slow because it rains. Of course, we should slow down when it's raining. Oh, this is going to feel so good. Oh, with my last breath, I stab at thee, white car from Florida, to quote Captain Ahab, except I don't want to die. All right, now back to Jeff's question. Those of you who are new listeners, that happens sometimes. Because the most important thing on the Christian commute is driving home safely. Now let's get back to Jeff's question. All right, so Jews do have some idea of the resurrection. All right, but they're not thinking the most important thing in their world is to die and go to heaven and not go to hell. All right, they are still waiting, some believing Jews, for their Messiah. So they think a Messiah could come to save them and restore them to earthly prominence or earthly power, just like people expected in Jesus' day. But they're not waiting for a Messiah to come in and graft in the Gentiles and start a spiritual kingdom like Jesus did. So they're waiting for the resurrection, just like Christians, but when they get to the resurrection, it ain't going to work out for them because their name's not written in the Lamb's Book of Life because they didn't believe. So Jews who reject Jesus are waiting for another Messiah, and they really don't care about how they're going to get to heaven or not because they don't have the same kind of New Testament identified heaven and hell beliefs that we have, because their special revelation stops at the Old Testament, stops in Malachi. So they don't care what Jesus said or the apostles said in the epistles. They don't read Revelation with any authority. So, Jeff, I hope that answers your question. And always remember this, that the early church was heavily Jewish. So the people who were faithful Jews of the day, who when Jesus came and they looked at their Old Testament prophecy and they said, oh, this is the guy, they believed in Jesus and became Christians. Think about Acts 17, the Bereans. Paul went to these people, and what did they do? They consulted the Scripture to compare what he was saying. And the Bible says that they were noble for doing so. So, what you have in modern-day Judaism is a hollowed-out remnant of a once pertinent religion. So, Jeff, I don't think you've been listening the whole time, but listeners like Jason from Florida, who doesn't drive a slow white car, I believe, what longtime listeners will have already heard me say is that I consider myself Jewish, in that I am a part of God's Israel. I am one of His elect people. And Judaism, or I should say this, what we describe as Christianity now is basically just the rightful extension of the Jewish religion. Jesus came, read Hebrews, He was the perfect Passover lamb. Everything culminates in Jesus. The shadow goes to substance, and the old covenant transitions into the new covenant, and all these Jewish practices are, we don't need them anymore. So Jews are just, whatever they're doing in their worship, it's just outmoded and old and irrelevant. So they're just wrong. How can I put it that way? They just missed the boat. And they're basically what's the opposite of ancestors? Predecessors? They're the predecessors. No, that's not right. Yeah, I think they're the predecessors of their ancestors. So the Jews who rejected Christ in Christ's day, they keep up with their false religion and false beliefs. But the Jews who really believe, the elect Jews of Jesus' days, who became Christian and believed their scriptures, well, they're the true Jews, and they kept going on. And now they've been mixed into Christianity as a whole because the Gentiles have been grafted in. So that there's really no ethnic Jewish identity within Christianity, but they were there from the beginning. So just in short, Jeff, how do modern Jews think they're going to get to heaven without Jesus? That's like they don't even care. Their idea of heaven and hell is different from ours. So I hope that helped answer your question. I'm sorry for the interlude of the slow person from Florida whom I could not get around. Now let's go to the show topic suggestion. Threats from within, business model. So this continues my series of show topics about threats to the visible church from within the visible church. So I'm not talking about the gay rights lobby. I'm not talking about Islamic hordes who want to take over the country, blow us all up, and you know, remove religious liberty as a freedom we have and make us pay the jizra, whatever their tax is. All right. So I'm not talking about anything like that. I'm not talking about secular humanism. I'm not talking about Common Core or anything like that. And, you know, all these things conservatives worry about, especially conservative Christians. I'm talking about from people who say they're Christians who are doing a disservice to the church and what we have to watch out for. Because remember, as I have said in a previous show, hard to keep doing these shows because I'm running out of show topics and new things to say. There's nothing new under the sun anyway. First, we need to clean our own house. So before we go out there worrying about the Human Rights Campaign and the Southern Poverty Law Center and the Democratic Party and Muslim terrorists, etc., etc., we need to first clean our own house. Somewhere there's some peaceful American riding in his car who happens to be a non-Christian, somehow listening to the show with a Human Rights Campaign sticker saying, "Did this guy just compare me to Muslims who want to blow us up?" Hey, wickedness is wickedness, dude, but no, I ain't afraid of you trying to blow me up. Alright, so that's the general direction I'm going in with these show topics, alright? So we've done charismaticism, and we've done ecumenism, and I want to do dominionism, but I think that really kind of fits in with charismaticism. We've done worldliness, so in between charismaticism and worldliness, I might have covered dominionism without talking about the Seven Mountains or the postmillennialism outright, but I don't know. Maybe I'll do that, maybe I won't. But let's talk about business models. What is your church's business model? All right? So always like to lead in with a story. I was at my church last night. We're having church conference, our quarterly conference, where we vote on what we're going to do, or, you know, what did we do last conference? What do we need to do now? And one of the things we talked about is, well, we need a new playground. Because the playground we have is, the equipment's old and it's kind of beat up, and there's getting to be some safety issues. And everybody understands, hey, we need a new playground. Because we have activities there, and the kids need somewhere to play. And to me, that's the end of it. You know, that's nice for the kids. It's fine to have a playground at the church. I would never say we need a new playground because we need to attract families with children. And we discussed why we need a new playground. Well, for safety, and this one's old, and we need to improve our playground. And everybody was in agreement, it seemed, that we needed a new playground. And after we'd all agreed and talked about safety, the pastor mentioned that, you know, hey, by the way, if there's a family coming to church and they're visiting and they have young kids and we have a nice new playground instead of a dangerous playground, they might want to consider that if they're joining our church. But that's not why we're getting a new playground. But there are some churches under some models who think we need to get a new playground because we need to attract the 30-year-old demographic. If we don't get a new playground, then, you know, 30-year-olds are going to go over to XYZ Baptist Church. And quite frankly, my church is outgunned, realistically speaking, if we think that we're going to, like, build playgrounds and stuff like that to attract kids, because First Baptist will beat our brakes off if we do that. They have a great kids area. But that's not how we should think about church growth. The way to think about church growth is, if the Lord wills it, He'll grow the church. And what we're going to do is faithfully proclaim the gospel and disciple people. And the numbers are going to be where the numbers are going to be. But that's not good enough for some churches, especially churches that are run by entrepreneurial people. So now what's become popular, and what it even gets taught in seminary, is basically the model of people like Bill Hybels and Andy Stanley and Rick Warren that become seeker-sensitive and business-driven and demographic-driven. And they think, how can we get people to come? How can we get them interested? And how can we get them to stay? My former pastor, who is also a former youth pastor of mine, he used to work at First Baptist in Cartersville. And they intentionally tried, according to the story he tells me, to, you know, Disney-fy their nursery area. Now, the thing about First Baptist is, they're inerrantists, you know, they're in the fundamentalist modernist controversy or the moderate conservative controversy. Pretty much all the moderates got out of there. All right, so it's been a conservative church. And when you think about those people, they want to attract people so they can save them and have them walk down the aisle, I think. But where the problem gets in is charlatans can use this business model too. And it gets to be from people like Tavner Smith in Chattanooga at the Venue Church, which I've talked about, or Andy Stanley, or Bill Hybels, which I've talked about, or Perry Noble. And it seems when I look at these people, they want nothing more than to get people in and get their money and grow a big organization, and that's what it's all about. And there's a spectrum from, I want to start a church like a business and get all your money, all the way to, well, I want to do things like Disney to get you in, but that's only because I really believe the gospel and the Bible's inerrant, and I want to attract you in there so I can teach you that. So one is nefarious and one is just wrong-headed, but at least they mean well. And that's the problem with what could be considered another threat, and I don't know if I'll do a separate show on this, another threat to the church, which would be decisionism, semi-Pelagianism. We're going to attract lost people in, we're going to make ourselves appealing to lost people, and then they're going to get saved and be a part of this church. Or we'll just keep them as lost people as part of the church as long as possible. Maybe even let them serve like Andy Stanley lets them do. And they'll stay here and maybe eventually they'll get saved, hopefully. And by the way, it's raining pretty hard, so sorry for the, you know, if that's messing up the audio. And they adapt business practices, business models like a for-profit business would adapt. Like, how are we going to get this demographic? How are we going to make them comfortable? How are we going to keep them coming? How are we going to get their money? You know, how do we get them giving and staying? And a church that's full of discipled people doesn't have to fight to make people stay and make people give, because the more you're discipled, the more you're going to be invested in your church and want to serve in your church without anybody trying to browbeat or trick you into doing it. Nobody has to give you a spiritual gifts inventory, that's a modern psychology test, and say, oh look, you're gifted at administration and you like sports, why don't you run the Upward program? When I was at First Baptist Woodstock, we all took the spiritual gifts inventory on the computer. And they sent it back and said, you like basketball. You're spiritually gifted to run the Upward program. Okay. So, and you know, that's how it works. So if you're just spiritually gifted and discipled, you're just going to do organically, if you will, find your place of service in the church. And nobody's going to have to tell you to do it, because you're going to just say, hey, can I do this? You're just going to start doing it because it's the right thing to do. And that comes into giving. You're going to be a cheerful giver. You're going to say, I want to contribute to the work of the Lord at my church, and I'm going to give a significant portion of my income. You know, not just the cast off. I'm going to give the widow's mite, not just out of my extra. And that's what people are going to start doing. And you don't have to strategize discipled Christians into doing that. But here's the thing. The Lord only gives so many of those. He may only give your church 100, and they may only reproduce 100. But when you have these other business modeled schemes with psychological manipulation, well, you can grow 100 into 1,000. But what do you have? Well, you got 100 saved people and 900 lost people, and you have a quote-unquote church of 1,000. You're getting plenty of money in. The staff is being paid better. But they're being paid better to goat herd and strategize and make the nursery look like Disney World. And then, as that's taught in church, two things happen. One, people who aspire to be churchmen or clergymen think, this is how it's done. And if I ever want to be successful, success defined by numbers, I have to do it like all these other people who are growing numbers. And then they just keep creating consumeristic churches. And then people are discipled into consumerism. And then people start to think the church is here to appeal to me. So if the church across town has a better guitar player and a better band, and their preacher works out, he does CrossFit, and he looks good in his skinny jeans and tight sweater, and he really struts like the cock of the walk up there, and they got a good band, and they have a really hip and with it kids program, I'm going to move my family there because this appeals to us more. Forget that my church over here is faithful and teaches the right things. It's just not the place to be. This place over here is attracting me more. So you go there for 2 years. But then all of a sudden, another church across town gets an even more charismatic preacher. I don't mean charismatic in like hap-a-blab, oob-a-da-bop-bop. No, I don't mean that. I mean charismatic in, you know, a good speaker and a great bubbly personality that attracts people. So they hire in the next church grower from out of town. It's like getting free agents. Instead of developing pastors in their farm system, so to speak. So think about like this for a major league team. They draft people into the farm system. They have instructors who teach them how to hit and throw. They have scouts who went out and looked at these people and said, these are good people to have in our system. And they grow them from an 18-year-old high school ball player, so that by the time they're 23, they're major league ready, and they bring them to their major league team. They've developed them from within. I think that's how churches should develop elders and deacons, from within. But what happens is the churches try to be like the New York Yankees, and they just buy big free agents. Get me Alex Rodriguez, get me Brian McCann, get me Mark Teixeira, and we're going to fill up these stadiums because we're going to pay home run hitters that people want to see. So you've become a consumerist, and you've left town for skinny jeans church number one, and all of a sudden some other church has some rich guy there who reaches into his bank account and brings in an even better free agent. So you leave all the people that you've covenanted with there. Of course, you never signed a church covenant. It's a super cool church. But you leave all your covenant church people over there because some of them want to go to the new hipper church. And it's just like, well, you know, I used to eat at Moe's in Cartersville, but then they built a Willie's and it's newer and I like it a little better. And then one day somebody's going to come in and build a Chipotle and I'm going to eat there. Except Seth doesn't eat at Chipotle because I don't like cilantro. So give me Moe's over Chipotle any day. And I think Willie's is too expensive. But my wife likes to go to Willie's. Anyway, you see how that works? I shop at Publix, but then they built a Super Kroger. So here's in Cartersville, they built a Kroger. And that's where people shopped. And then Publix came in and built a Publix. And everybody knows Publix is nicer than Kroger. Come on! The level of service! Look how many lanes are open when you go to Publix. Yeah, it's a little more expensive, but we all know it's better. All right, so now Publix is beating out Kroger. So what does Kroger do in Cartersville? Well, Kroger builds a new Super Kroger with a gas station. They sell clothes at Super Kroger, and it's all new. So now people stop shopping at Publix, and they go to Kroger, except me, because I know where everything is at Publix. So that's how that works. How do we attract the consumers to move around? And that's how churches do. They compete with one another. First Baptist Woodstock competes with Johnson Ferry Baptist Church. Two mega churches in the same denomination, 30 miles from one another. They do. They compete for the youth, and they compete for the youth's parents. And they disciple people into consumerism, and then church leaders go they learn how to be leaders and vision casters instead of pastors. Being a pastor turns into be a leader and vision caster. And all of a sudden, Church Inc. happens, and it's Mick Church. And you can't really tell the difference between Corporation ABC and XYZ Baptist Church. And that's a threat from within. And we have to stop it. The McChurch movement. The church franchise movement. Gosh, I've railed against church franchises on this show for so long. It almost seems like this Threats from Within series is just recycled topics from a year ago because I'm running out of things to say. Mm-hmm. So yeah. Threats from within, the business model. So how do you apply this at your local church? It all starts with the playground, y'all. It all starts with the playground. Is the board of deacons or the building committee saying we need a new playground to attract new families? Or are they saying we need a new playground to serve the families we already have? And yeah, bonus, it attracts new families. Nothing wrong with that. Of course you want people to come to your church and you want to grow it. I'm not against growing the church. You want to disciple people and multiply. That's exactly what we should do. Nothing wrong with church growth if done the right way. Don't grow for growth's sake. So that's what I'm saying. It all starts at your church. Do you go to your church business meetings? Maybe you need to start going. It all starts with that. What is the attitude at your church business meeting? What is the attitude at the people who've been put in charge of managing the church? Are they trying to do things to attract people? Or are they trying to do things to disciple people? Because that will tell you if your church is going to slide into the Church Inc. model or stick with the biblical one. Because I can tell you guys, I've been to seminary, I've taken the classes, I've seen scientific management, Frederick Taylor, I've seen vision casting that they teach me in management training. I've seen a Bible verse stamped on that and taught as if it's the way to lead a church. Church of the Tares, that is my assignment for you. Homework assignment for the Christian community. Get on YouTube, watch the little documentary, Church of the Tares. It's great, it's worth your 2 hours, and it's better than watching New England play the Eagles. See, look, I had a little bit of awareness in NFL football there. Thanks for listening to the Christian Commute. Lord willing, I'll be back with you again tomorrow. Don't forget to write in to SethDunn88@gmail.com. SethDunn88@gmail.com. That is the Christian Commute inbox. That is your theological roadside assistance. Send in your questions about theology, apologetics. Send in your show topic suggestions. Thanks for listening, and as always, God bless.